From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When we think about the institution of slavery in America, we think of slave-owning whites as almost always men. White men were the perpetrators, the one who spearheaded the slave trade and who pressed for the continued enslavement of African Americans. But what about white women? Were they passive bystanders, or were they active participants in enslavement? Now a new book draws on detailed historical research to make the case that white women saw themselves as slave owners and directly participated in and benefited from the institution. My guest is Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers, Assistant Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. She's the winner of the 2013 Lerner Scott Prize for Best Doctoral Dissertation in U.S. Women's History. And she joins me to discuss her brand new book. It's called They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South. Welcome to the program, Stephanie.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
So why is it that this history is so little known? Why do we not think of white women as having been active participants? It seems as though our sort of American culture has swept white women slave owners and their status as slave owners under the rug.
Well, I think there are several reasons why we have tended to think of white women as passive bystanders or indirect beneficiaries of the institution of slavery. One has to do with historians. Many of the histories of slavery for many decades were written by men, and there was very few women who were involved in the narration, the narrativization of the history of slavery. And so when you think about the fact that we are self-interested. Many historians, you know, we like to think of ourselves as objective, objective observers. But in many respects, we are very deeply invested in the histories that we tell. And so many of these men wrote stories about the individuals who they were most interested in, and those were white men who they did very eloquently demonstrate were deeply invested in the institution of slavery. The second reason why I think we rarely hear about the very active roles, economic roles that white women played in the institution of slavery is in large part because of this legal doctrine called coverture. I talk about this extensively in the book. And what this doctrine basically provided was, or stipulated, was that when a woman owned any property, if she had any property that she inherited from someone, if she bought any property, she was able to possess that property as long as she wasn't married. But once she married, that property and all the kind of assets that would be, that would come from that property became her husband's. And so many historians have looked at this legal doctrine, have looked at the ways in which this doctrine kind of is discussed in the 19th century during the era of slavery, and have largely dismissed these women in large part because they believe that this legal doctrine, that this law, that the way that the law was structured around white women's or women's ability or inability to own property, that it foreclosed the possibility that these women would be able to be directly invested in an economic way in the institution of slavery. And so many of the stories that we know about women in large part remove the economic element in large part because of this legal dimension, this the impact that this law was allegedly had on the lives of all married women in the South, but also in the North, in the entire United States.
So in terms of enslaved African Americans being viewed as property, at what age were white women essentially given this property? You write in your book that little girls at a very young age were put, you know, were basically told that this adult human being was their property and would transfer to them when they were adults.
Well, that's a wonderful observation, really important point that I make in the beginning of the book, because I think that when we talk about those stories, the narratives of slavery, the histories of slavery that we're familiar with, they often start when women are women, when they're adults. And so that, I think, also lends itself to why we don't typically hear about the economic investments that women have in the institution of slavery. So by starting the story much earlier and by looking to what formerly enslaved and enslaved people have to say about white women's economic investments in the institution, we learn that this investment didn't begin when these women became women, when these white females became adults. The relationship really began when they were only infants. So there are instances in which white female infants, 9 months old, are given enslaved people as their own, as gifts, as birthday gifts, as Christmas gifts. And what you also see is that as they progress to certain coming of age moments, so at the age of 16 or at the age of 18, when they are married, those milestones that we celebrate even today, women, these females, these white females, were actually being given enslaved people as their own. So the story begins with childhood, with infancy, and they learn very early on that there's this really important part of their identities that's connected to the ownership of enslaved African Americans.
So then these women are socialized. They were socialized as they were raised, as they grew into adulthood, to view these human beings that they saw in their house, that they interacted with, as their property.
Absolutely. So, of course, you know, I think it's important for me to note that this is a process of socialization. This is not the book does not make an argument that, you know, immediately upon birth, you know, white females are racist or they learn about white supremacy. This is a process that takes place over the course of their lives. It's a process that begins very, very early on. And so, yes, they are socialized immediately when they are born into this culture of violence, this culture of enslavement and bondage, of white supremacy. They slowly learn, the learning process begins almost immediately. They slowly learn that they have the power, the control, the ability to own other human beings. Mm-hmm. So it does, in fact, a process of socialization that happens over the course of their lives and doesn't just begin once they're adults and they marry into slavery, so to speak.
So then, as adults, how did white women fight to keep their property? And you write about this in your book. What were some of the legal challenges they faced, and how hard did they work to essentially ensure that the so-called the property that included owning human beings remained in their ownership and benefited them economically?
That's a really important question, and it drives the argument that I make. It's very much an economic argument, but it's grounded upon a legal one. So as I mentioned, there's this doctrine called coverture, which essentially says that single women or widowed women who own property or who earn wages, that property and those wages, those assets, that wealth immediately becomes their husband's upon marriage. And so women know this. You know, white females, they grow up knowing about this legal doctrine. They might not know the particularities of the law, but they are told through their parents, you know, through conversations with their parents, through conversations with each other, through the rumor mill, through their social networks, that they should expect this when they get married. And so not only do they work with their parents, but also work independently with friends. You know, they might seek advice through friends. They work around these constraints. They figure out what loopholes exist in the laws that would allow for them to acquire property or to maintain the property and secure the property that they already own for their own use and within their own control before they get to that point. So these women are very savvy. Their parents are very, very helpful in this process, and they actually help them to develop strategies to circumvent these constraints upon their abilities to own property more broadly, but in this particular case, to own slaves. And I think the ownership of slaves is very important in this context, I think in large part because, you know, judges that are sitting on these courts and juries that are sitting on courts when women's property rights are infringed upon or jeopardized in some way, their ownership of enslaved people happen to be jeopardized in some way. These are slave owners. Most of the individuals who form the juries in the South, most of the judges are slave owners. So they see in these women participants in, active members in a system that benefits white people like themselves. So they see themselves in these young girls and these women. They see their daughters and their wives in their female kin in these women. And so in many respects, what I've learned through my review of these legal cases is that judges frequently rule in the favor of these women. They uphold these women's rights to own human beings.
What was the relationship between white women and the people that they enslaved, particularly the Black women that they enslaved? Tell us about the way in which white women's role as the managers of their households led to a very particular relationship with Black women, particularly as wet nurses for their children, for their white children.
So there's a very, I think, abundant amount of scholarship that's been written on the relationships between white women and the enslaved women who worked within their households. Typically, the scholarship does not examine the relationship, the very, I think, distinct relationship between white women who owned enslaved people, who owned those enslaved people working in their households, and how ownership shaped those relationships. And so by looking at this very intimate relationship within a broader economic context, what I was able to discover is that just looking at this one case study in which white women who have children who, for whatever reason, either because they just don't want to or because for physiological reasons they are unable to nurture their children, to nurse their children, to breastfeed their children, heavily rely upon enslaved women's reproductive and maternal labor. They rely upon these women to suckle their children. That by looking at that relationship, not simply as an intimate one, but also as an economic one, what you find is that these relationships are very much defined by the economy of slavery. These very intimate maternal relationships, domestic, with quotations around it, relationships that often remain cloaked within the household or hidden behind the curtains of the household, are very much economic relationships when you realize that these women are property, that enslaved women are property, that the women who are employing them as wet nurses, that are purchasing them for that purpose, that are hiring them for that purpose, see these women as economic units as well as reproductive units, and also as human beings that are capable of giving their children the kind of nutritive care as well as maternal care that they may not be able to provide them or may not want to provide to them. So it's a very intimate economic relationship as well.
What happened to the children of those Black women? Presumably, Black women were able to nurse the white children because they themselves had recently been mothers.
Absolutely. There are many accounts of formerly enslaved women, and their children are typically the ones that give these accounts, which I think is a really powerful and important point to make, that often the accounts that we have of these enslaved women serving as wet nurses come from their children. And many of these accounts actually demonstrate that these enslaved women are often having children at the same time or around the same times as the white women whose children they later breastfeed. And because of kind of the racial notions of racial inferiority, it's very complex and very confusing. It's a kind of ideological process that's happening in these moments. But because of the notions of racial inferiority, the idea that Black women may and also may not be the same in terms of physiologically as white women, there are all these kind of apprehensions around having Black women nurse their own children or nurse Black children while also nursing white children. So it's really interesting to see that what they will typically do to kind of help to mitigate or assuage their fears or their anxieties around the kind of simultaneous labor that enslaved women would have to provide or perform for their white children as well as their own enslaved children, they will typically separate these enslaved women from their children. And these enslaved children are often forced to be bottle fed, which in this moment in time was a very dangerous and unhealthy practice that pediatricians or individuals who we would consider pediatricians today strongly advised against doing. And they would often separate these women when they sold them away from their children or hired them to individuals who took them away from their children. So these mothers, in the moment in which they're caring the most for their own infants' well-being, they're also dismissing and dismissing the well-being of other children and separating other mothers from their children when they need them the most.
And presumably some of the children that these Black women were made to nurse would be gifted these women as property at a young age, continuing
Absolutely.
That whole cycle.
Absolutely. So there's one account that I discuss in the book where a woman is saying, "Oh yes, my mistress and I were born around the same time, and my mother and her mother were born around the same time, and their mothers were born around the same time." And so there's this kind of multi-generational transmission or circulation of labor that these women are descendants of other women who similarly engage in these practices, engage in separating enslaved mothers from their children in order to care for their own, to provide care for their own. So you see this kind of multi-generational process. And I think that links back to this issue of socialization. These women learn as young girls that this is what happens in our world, that this is okay in our world here in the context of Southern slavery. So yes, yeah, so they it's an intergenerational, multi-generational thing.
What about the white women owners of Black men? What was that relationship like?
So this is an element of the relationship that white women had to the institution of slavery, whether they be simply living in households where slaves existed and they did not own them, or whether they own them, that tends to be discussed very little, or just discussed in passing mention in many scholarly examinations of slavery. And I think it's in large part because there is a kind of sexual kind of under current to these kind of the things that we think of when we think about white women and black men. And I think in large part because of what happens after slavery is over, with the rise of the KKK, with the rise of white supremacist movements, violent white supremacist terrorist organizations that penalize black men for having, in many respects, consensual relationships with white women, or even the idea that they might have relationships with white women because they're now free to do so. So I think that longer history, that more recent history, kind of taints the way we think about white women's relationships to enslaved men, whether they own them or whether they didn't own them in the earlier slavery era. But taking the sexual dimension out for a second, they very much engaged with enslaved men in the ways that they engaged with enslaved women. If it came down to power or violence or the perpetration of violence or punishment or discipline, these women sometimes would, in fact, mete out that punishment to enslaved men with their own hands. But often, just like white men did when they wanted to punish an enslaved man, they would delegate that task to others. So I think, you know, taking the sexual element out for a second, also thinking about all the various ways that women could delegate the task of violence to others, they engage very much in very many of the same ways that white men did with enslaved men, especially if they own them.
As the as history progressed and as the institution of slavery eventually began cracking under the many attacks it faced, both legal and through brave action by people themselves who were enslaved and by abolitionists in general, how did white women's relationship to slavery as a whole change? Were they part of that reactionary backlash or resistance in the South in particular that we sort of think of white men as having engaged in, you know, fighting, basically willing to fight a war to preserve their right to own human beings?
That's a really important question. And I think it's one that I hope that is a really important takeaway from the book for scholars or for individuals who are just really interested in the Civil War era and kind of see women or imagine that white women's roles were kind of, again, kind of Scarlett O'Hara-esque. I hope that they take away from this book that that is very much a falsity. It's very much an inaccurate description or portrayal of many white slave owning women, many white women, Southern women's reaction to the Civil War, to the possibility that slavery would be abolished, but also for slave owning women, it was really, really an important and critical moment for them as women. And the argument that I make in this book is that because white women would typically be given more enslaved people than they would other forms of property, for example, land, they were in some cases far more deeply invested in the institution of slavery and its perpetuation than some white men were. Many of these white women that I study and then that I talk about in the book, they were the ones that brought the enslaved people to the marriage. So their husbands may not have owned any property at all. They were the ones that brought the property to the marriage. So for women like them, when not only were they perhaps the only property owners, the only slave owners in their households, but also maybe that's the only property that they owned, slaves were their means, their mode of economic stability, and in some cases, their mode of autonomy, the ways in which they were able to secure certain kinds of control over their lives and in their lives, because they were respected as property owners. And when slavery was challenged, when the possibility that slavery would be abolished emerged as a consequence of the war, throughout the war, women fought staunchly to preserve and to protect their investments in the institution. And when they saw the writing on the wall, when they realized that slavery could not be saved, that it would not be preserved, that the Confederacy was going to lose, they were very, very angry, and they acted out violently and not just in complicity, but they enacted violence and they perpetrated violence, and white terror violence after slavery was over in order to try to secure the kind of free labor that they had on the institution of slavery.
What form did that violence take? I mean, again, we think of it's mostly white men that we imagine when we think of, say, lynch mobs.
Right. So women did not, from what I've read, they did not actively participate in kind of the Night Riders, which are kind of these white terrorist groups, terrorist organizations that would kind of, again, ride through the night and terrorize black communities, would you know, kind of abduct and brutalize black men and black women if they did not kind of behave in the ways that they did before slavery was over or during slavery. So I don't know if white women actively participated in those kinds of terrorist activities, but they certainly supported those terrorist activities. And on a kind of case-by-case basis, on the ground, in intimate encounters between these women, white women, and formerly enslaved people, they threatened violence, they perpetrated violence, so they would continue to whip them, to punish them when they worked for them in the same ways that they did before slavery was over. There are instances in which women the enslaved people who worked for certain women would go to authorities and would report these women for threatening to, quote unquote, blow their brains out if they didn't leave their land after they asked for payment for their work. So these women were, in fact, very, very willing to engage in brutal and sometimes fatalistic acts of retaliation against formerly enslaved people after slavery was over.
So finally, let's talk a little bit about the basis of your research and the subjects that you center in your book. Where did you get most of the source material that you base your history book on?
So when I first started this project, I began this project out of kind of a immense frustration, because as I was studying the scholarship written about enslaved African Americans and free African Americans, though the scholars that wrote the historians that wrote that scholarship were saying something very different, or they were portraying the relationship between the economic relationship between white women and enslaved people and formerly enslaved people in a very different way than the scholarship on the South, the scholarship on slavery more broadly, and particularly the scholarship on white Southern women. And so I was compelled to look for the answer. Who's right here? You know, whose story can be corroborated? Which one of these is really accurate? And so I looked to the white women's diaries, their letters, to see what they were saying about their economic investments in the institution of slavery. And while they might say something in passing mention, say something very briefly, there was no prolonged, extensive discussion of this in the majority of these documents, these letters and these diaries. So I was compelled to look elsewhere. And so I looked to what formerly enslaved people were saying about these women. They often talked about women who owned them. They talked about women who bought and sold them. They talked about women who had bought and sold or owned family members, or husbands and wives. So they often talked about these women as having a direct economic relationship in the institution. And I said, but I know that there are skeptics out there who will say, well, what do these formerly enslaved people really know about this? And so I looked elsewhere to corroborate what formerly enslaved people were saying. And so I found corroboration in legal sources, in financial sources, in the military letters that Union officials were and also Confederate officials were writing back and forth to their superiors. So there was copious evidence to support what formerly enslaved people and enslaved people were saying about white women's economic investments in the institution. So this story that I tell in this book is the story that formerly enslaved and enslaved people had to tell, what they had to say about the white women in their lives, the white women who owned them, the white women who had profound and deep economic investments in their continued enslavement and bondage. And so for me, this book is about them. This book is their book. They are the ones who told me where to go, who suggested, you know, paths to take. So this book would not have been written without formerly enslaved and enslaved people's accounts and recollections and reflections upon the white women in their lives and the economic dimensions of those relationships with white women.
It seems to me that the silence around white women's relationship with slavery were both based on the sense that they are innocent, and white women's innocence is a very important, you know, historical trope in white supremacy, but also that they lacked agency. And of course, we live in a patriarchy, and so the admission that white women had any agency is also part of the story, right?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. So, you know, I call this feminism an ugly kind of feminism. This is a feminist story. It very much is a feminist story. It's a story about female empowerment. It's a story about women who were emboldened by their ability to kind of carve out a kind of power and control over their lives and autonomy in their lives. But unfortunately, they were able to do that by owning other people. So it's a very feminist story. It is a story about agency, but it's not the kind of agency and it's not the kind of liberty and freedom and autonomy or female freedom and autonomy that we want to know about, that we want to see, that we want to read about. So it is very much a story about how these women figured out a way to secure for themselves certain rights, certain freedoms, but that freedom was based upon slavery. Their freedom was slavery and their ability to invest in slavery. So while yes, they didn't topple the patriarchy, yes, many of these women aren't saying, I'm oppressed, so I'm going to oppress other people so that I cannot be, or I can be less oppressed. This was not a feminist project for them. But nevertheless, what they did was what today we recognize as like you said, these are actions that secured to them some kinds of power, agency, and control of their lives that they would not otherwise have had they not had access to this economic economic system that allowed for them to control other human beings and to participate in a white supremacist project of Black oppression.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Stephanie, for joining us today. Congratulations on the book and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers, Assistant Professor of History at University of California, Berkeley. She's the winner of the 2013 Lerner Scott Prize for Best Doctoral Dissertation in U.S. Women's History. And we've been discussing her new book, They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.